Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is part two of the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 100. So episode 100 is a two-parter. So is it episode 100 and 101? No, it's not. It's 100.0 and 100.1 or something like that. I don't know. But thank you for tuning in. Speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's all I'm going to do to plug that because I plugged it a load in the last one. I'm now going to go through the second of 50 guests because it means a lot to get to 100. And I'm sorry that this is the longest and most rambling intros that we've had, but you know, it means the world. And next week, I should mention now, we're going to have, I've not recorded them yet, but we're going to have some drunk casts. And anyone who's listened to the drunk cast, which is me, my mate Chris and my mate Stu, we have a drink and we talk about things that have been in the news or films or music or things that we've been up to personally or stories that we've got, and we get drunk while we're doing it. And the first one was meant to be one or two episodes long and ended up being five. The second one was three episodes long. So I don't know how long it'll be or how many it'll be, but there's drunk casts to come. So enjoy that. Right, episode 51 was my birthday special. So it was released on my birthday, which is the same date as the book comes out this year, August 3rd. And it was with my mum and dad. And it meant the world because I wanted to have a podcast with them and discuss them splitting up. Because we live in a world today where people seem to put so much pressure on the traditional family setup that if it doesn't work, then you've failed your family in some way. My parents split up. And it was for the best for everyone. I wouldn't be as happy a person as I am now if they'd stayed together, I don't think. So I wanted to discuss that. And also, that was probably the most emotional podcast I've been involved in because I talked to my dad for the first time about the day he came and told us he was leaving. And I think as a kid, it was the first time I saw him cry. And that's a huge thing with your old man kind of thing. They're the big, strong hero. And to see them suddenly frail and weak is weird. And it was an emotional podcast and we both teared up a bit in it. So yeah, that was episode 51. And then I had a two-part Greenpeace special. Was it three-part? It might have been a three-part special with Greenpeace. And that was amazing because that was with Ben and Frank, and it was talking about the Arctic mission where they got taken and put in Russian prison and didn't think they were ever going to get out. So that's kind of amazing. Next up was Dr. Susie Gage, who I'm glad that's come up because she now has her own podcast on the network, which in part one I forgot to thank you all for. It's called Say Why to Drugs, and it launched a couple of weeks ago now. There's a new episode up now. Oh, no, a new episode up tomorrow. I'm thinking of the dates. Yeah, there should be a new episode up tomorrow. And it went straight in at number... It was the number one science and medicine podcast on iTunes, and it got as high as number 7 in the full iTunes chart. So considering it was the first episode of a podcast, that it got to number 7 in the iTunes chart was absolutely amazing. And you guys are completely responsible for that. It's given so much weight and power to this Distraction Pieces network, so thank you for that. But check it out. They're called Say Why to Drugs, and each episode it's Susie. And for the first 5 episodes, it's Susie and me. And I ramble a lot on them, but please bear in mind that Susie is new to podcasts, so, and I've been doing them a long time, so there was an element of me taking the lead more than I would do just on those first few to kind of ease it all into it and get the facts in smoothly. So yeah, and it's picking a different recreational drug each week and breaking down the facts about it, dispelling the myths. It's not pro drugs, it's not anti drugs, it's pro fact and anti myth essentially. So yeah, next up was Hugh Stevens, who we talk about in this episode with Dan. And then I had a mortician on called Carla Valentine, who's absolutely amazing and also features in the book. Frank Carter of Gallows and Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes was up next. That's one of my albums of the year. I had a dream about Frank Carter last night actually, and I declared how he was my that Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes album was my album of the year so far. Weird. Then we had Tall Dark Friend, who, I mean, I'm not taking full credit for this, but Tall Dark Friend is a young lady who lives in Tilbury, or from Tilbury, which is up the road from me, and was born physically, or with the physical attributes of a male, and has gone through, yeah, is a transgender individual. But since then, she only bowled onto The Voice and became hugely famous and was part of P- Team Paloma and absolutely smashed it. And yeah, amazing. So that was a good one. Tom Davis was up next, who was hilarious. Andrew Shim from This Is England and Room for Romeo Brass and everything was fantastic. Garth Ennis, my favourite, probably my favourite comic book writer, and the writer of Preacher, which the series has started recently. And I'm going to tell you what I think about that on next week's Drunk Cast, because I need to talk to about it with Chris. Preston from The Ordinary Boys was next. He was absolutely an absolute delight. Brett Goldstein and John Drever were up next, who were, that was one of my favourites as well, because that was just sitting down with mates and having a laugh and taking the piss. Up next was Roots Maneuver, which I was hugely proud of because he's a legend. Tom Robinson, two-parter there, was absolutely amazing. Again, a lot of that has made it into the book because he's such an inspirational and crazy story. Akala, another one that's, damn, that kid can talk and is intelligent. So made a lot in there. Then Adam Buxton, which was a massive one because I went on Adam's show. He came on my show. So that was great. Then we had the live Distraction Pieces podcast, the first one, part one and part two at the Leicester Square Theatre. And that was great fun, and you guys were amazing, and I can't wait to get back there on August 3rd. Then Chris Jericho, that was massive. I actually recorded one with Jericho for his podcast as well, and he keeps telling me it's going to be out soon. It's been months, so I don't know if he lost it or didn't record it, but I have a word with him. Richard Herring was up next. I then had Kurt Sutter on, two-part. Richard Herring was great, and I did his podcast as well. There was a good period there where I was doing everyone else's podcast and they, as they were doing mine. Kurt Sutter, part one and two, that was great. John Osborne, who was absolutely fantastic and a beautiful young man. Then I had Dale Vince from Ecotricity, and that was a green special, and it was fascinating. And I switched instantly over to Ecotricity, so that's the electricity and gas that I've got now, and it's green, and yeah, it's amazing. Then the next five were me, Chris and Stu getting drunk. And it's the first time a lot of you met any of those guys. And I'm annoyed at how well it went down because they're my mates, but they're fucking idiots and you shouldn't enjoy them so much. After that was Itch, which was fantastic, from King Blues. Then I did a fan questions one. Then was Robin Ince, which was amazing. And Jason Reed, who has a podcast that the first one is out very soon. It's called Stop and Search. It's on the Distraction Pieces Network. It's about, it's a panel podcast about drug law prohibition. And one of the first guests is Robin Ince, who I just mentioned. Up next was Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. That was an amazing comic book nerd one. Then we had Jim Smallman of Progress Wrestling, who also has a podcast now on the Distraction Pieces Network called Tuesday Night Jaw, which is going down a treat. So check that out. I'm almost done, I swear. Saul Williams was next. Amazing. Riker, absolutely amazing. That's where we launched the Scroobius Pip toy. We then had the Safe Housing for Women special with Mira that was heartbreaking but amazing. Stephen Graham, who I absolutely adore, yeah, is a wonderful man and a dear, dear friend now. We then had a Leap UK special, which are the people that Jason Reed works with. Blind Boy of the Rubber Bandits was amazing. Georgina Campbell was one of my favourite episodes because it's amazing when it's someone you meet for the first time and they're just so engaging and so easy to talk to. So that was great fun. Then we had a three-part Drunk podcast and then a Your Questions podcast and then Carl Barrett and then Ed Skrein, a two-part episode of Ed Skrein that went down an absolute treat and gave everyone a new life mantra. Then Michael Socker, who was just delightful. Kathy Burke, that one's gone down a treat and has spawned a few memes, which is always exciting to see. Then we had Izzy Sooty, who was just delightful and one of the best opening conversations we've ever had. Then Will Ospreay, who's a wrestler who wrestles one weekend in Japan in front of 11,000 people and then is back working on a building site in Essex a couple of days later. So that was an amazing one and went down a treat. And then last week, God, I'm getting a dry mouth. That was exhausting. We had David Earl and Joe Wilkinson, who David Earl has the character of Brian Gittins and Cumbo and numerous others. He's hilarious. Joe Wilkinson is on 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown and was Dan in Him and Her. And they wrote a series called Rovers, which is getting rave reviews at the moment. It's a new comedy and it's great. It's hilarious. So, oh, God damn, that's the 100. And thank you all for tuning in. I shouldn't have started that, but I started it and it's happened now. And Also, of course, as I mentioned in part one, it's worth mentioning again that our guest at We Are Lizards this month, my club night at the book club on Saturday, June 25th, is none other than Dan Lesac. So come down and hang out with both myself and Mr. Lesac, and we'll play all the best songs, all the best tunes. We'll have our residents there. It'll be a wonderful party as ever. Come on down, see you then. It'll be great. Let's get into the podcast, Dave. This is part two with Dan Lesac. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. And we're rolling on part two now.
Part two, mate.
So there's been a drink top up.
Yeah, I only went with half a glass. Lit. I don't want to waste too much fizzy pop.
Exactly.
I'm very limited in the amount I'm allowed.
You got to do that. So where do we get to? We got to us kind of starting together, essentially. So you'd built a MySpace page, because that's kind of interesting how we very much learnt on the job. And yeah. I think that's essential. Like I mentioned in the other half that there's been points I've not been happy with, or there's been things that a label have done that I felt, oh, that wasn't quite right. That's not an insult to anyone. That's us learning on the job. And
yeah. Are
we very much the first? So you'd remixed a couple of my tracks or one of my tracks, and then you did a couple more and said, look, let's do a Lesac versus Pip.
So did MySpace
page.
1,000 words.
Yep.
Straight off the bat. And that was just like an edit of the full track, just chopped up with a B. And then what, Angles was in those first
Angles
four?
And First Time We Met Music, first I think, time we were met in the music. First four, wasn't it?
And that was, that had these samples of a band, like a math rock arty
cats
band.
And Cats and Cats.
Cats and Cats and Cats and Cats and Cats and Cats.
And we never got to use that version, because we didn't get that. I really enjoyed that version.
I did too, I did. And then we did another version
that we released on a...
That
on
was something. For Sage.
Yeah, the US
which was
exclusive.
Rad as well. I was really glad we did that.
But yeah, I remember that. I remember getting kind of annoyed because we couldn't get it cleared, and it was like, oh man, that sounded cool. I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, I was more annoyed about not getting that cleared than the Radiohead thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Radiohead felt like it was never going to get it cleared anyway.
And then it did, which was absolutely insane. So yeah, I mean, on that respect, so we, it's weird because it feels like we had these long careers before we got together, but as we've discussed, we didn't at all, really. Mm. Like your first gig was my first gig, but we were separate. And but then we soon started doing gigs. Like, we were doing gigs separately. I was still gigging about doing spoken word and with my ghetto blaster and with a 6'2" pianist at times and things like that. But
we had long careers.
Yeah.
Just in our imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
We
you know, a lot of work to get there.
All that work before we released Thou Shalt was our careers. We might have had to have real jobs and didn't actually tell anyone we had careers, but you know, at
exactly
that point.
And so let's tell the story of Thou Shalt, I guess. I'd written Thou Shalt as a spoken word piece, and I'd purely written it as a tool to kind of use at open mics that I could, I've got this structure, I can add something specific to something that's happened in the news that day, or even I had won the open mic, I like the line, "Thou shalt not go to an open mic and leave after you've done your first poem or song, yourself righteous prick," was because of someone who had been put in the second half of Poetry Unplugged at the Poetry Cafe. And he'd been put in the second half and he was all grumpy because he'd had to sit through the first half. And then he got up and did his... And his poem wasn't even a poem. He'd translated a poem from Latin, which, that's dope. I don't know how to do that. Congratulations, mate. But still, my ignorant mind was like, you've not even written a poem, mate. You just got up and fucking translated something. And he finished,
like me turning
literally
up.
Walked from the stage out the door. Didn't even give the illusion of going to the toilet or sitting down.
It'd be like me turning up.
Thanks, guys. Fuck off.
A spoken word night and just doing like Biggie lyrics.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, isn't cool. It's poetry.
It's great, but...
But come on.
And he was really grumpy and posh. And I was up last, I think, not through any credit or known, it was just the luck of the draw, and I did Thou Shalt, and I added
thou shalt not go to an open mic and leave as soon as you don't. Yeah. That's why it's shitty little poem or song, because it was, in that version, it was shitty little poem, but I changed it to poem or song from the track because it's more relatable and marketable, particularly at the time poetry wasn't very big.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd had that kind of half written, and you sent me a beat that I loved, and I went upstairs to my bedroom at my mum's house.
Masturbated first, obviously.
I masturbated. Always. No, that's what I was downstairs doing.
So
I went upstairs and wrote the vocal, or adjusted the vocal and added the Just a Band bit, which was new, and recorded it and sent it back to you. And that was all in the time it took you to watch 40-Year-Old Virgin, I think it was.
Twice.
There you go.
I watched it twice.
So it's a good film.
Yeah.
That's cracking.
I used to do that. I didn't have a studio. We had a coffee table.
Yeah.
I'd sit on the sofa and I'd put a film on in the background, so there was like something happening in the room, and then I just headphone on laptop in front of me, and that laptop survived a long fucking time, man. It's over there now, like it's the case just falls off it at random and stuff, but
just falling apart. But that's how Thou Shalt came about, and then we put that on MySpace,
and then
it blew up from there.
Yeah,
I had Ed Skrein on the podcast the other week, who was Ajax in Deadpool, and is amazing. He's a rapper as well. He's a really good dude. And in his house, he had some photography by, who was the guy that pushed Thou Shalt on MySpace a lot? He was a skinhead photographer.
Oh God,
it's Ian something.
Yes, he's like from High Wycombe.
Yeah,
did a load of punk stuff.
It was just weird. He had this picture, and he was like, "Oh, it's by this guy." I was like, "Fuck, that guy was one of the first to
met him." Yeah, at a Reading show.
Yeah.
Can't remember his name.
Really good photographer and really good.
He listens. I feel like he might still be
And
around.
That was it. So we put Thou Shalt up, and he was someone that pushed it and had a bit of a following. And there was a few different people who started to push it off MySpace.
Yeah.
And then at that point, again, by chance, I'd done a couple of gigs with Jack Pignatti, and one I'd opened for Kate Nash at a gig with Ollie, and then we got booked to do the Kate Nash launch thing, and then we did a gig for John Kennedy Adele and Jack Pignatti.
We did
and us.
A gig.
That's a lineup, that.
I know. And wasn't Adele on first?
I think she might have been. I can't remember. I know Jack was. I'm sure Jack was headlining. So Jack, I think it was Adele and then us, then Jack.
Yeah.
And that was more, I think, because that's a good flow. Like Adele an acoustic guitar was a beautiful opener.
Yeah.
I think that was more.
Girl.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Full stop, man.
God love her.
So we actually did a gig. You were doing a gig with Dan Sartain.
Yeah.
And Dan Sartain pulled out.
Yeah, that's right. And I was promoting that.
You were promoting that.
I was promoting that, I think. I think I'd booked him. That's right. So we did a gig together. And that was the same place that I'd opened for Kate Nash. That was the Fly Bar.
The Fly.
In New Oxford Street.
Which is now called something like Housden or something.
Yeah. So, and that was, I'd booked Dan Sartain there. And it cancelled, and I wasn't a promoter. I just decided I'm going to try and book stuff. I tried to book Dose One at Plastic People, and I'd failed on all these things. But I booked him, and then it didn't happen, and I hit you up.
Yeah.
And that was kind of our first, another gig together.
Mm. So we did, you performed, and then we did like a couple of songs
together,
And then
you
performed,
and
did the thing.
Yeah.
Because you performed with Ollie, that's right.
Yeah,
and then
that's right.
I came up and we did Angles and maybe something else. There was a girl called Amy in the crowd.
Yeah.
I only ever met her there. But it was weird because she was like our biggest fan.
Right.
Yet, never saw her after that day. But for like 6 months, she just would post stuff on MySpace and like tell everyone.
Yeah, and then vanish.
I just found it really weird. Like
a bitch.
Just wonder where
the fuck did she go?
I don't know, man.
Stick around.
But I find it fascinating that I remember what she looks like.
Yeah.
I remember her name.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Strange. So we did that. And then John Kennedy played Thou Shalt Always Kill on the old radio. So we built, I said, but again, people say, oh, why is it verses? There wasn't any thought that went into it. I think you built our MySpace page,
just did
right?
A MySpace
and it was
page
just,
to
that's
put
it.
That stuff
just
up.
Dinosaur Sack versus Scroobius Pip. And John Kennedy played it, and then it all went nuts from there. And that was, and Thou Shalt, again, we should be clear, is the first song we wrote together. Or I wrote one of your things. There was a few songs that you'd put my vocal over your beat, or I'd, you know, things like that. Or there was an established beat that I'd then written to. But that was the first one that you went, I've made this, think you'll like it. Right, yeah. I can make this work.
And Thou Shalt's such a weird beat for us as well. Like, when you listen to it in context of everything, there's very few things like it.
Yeah.
And in the whole...
of our catalogue.
Catalogue, which is nice, man.
Yeah.
And that beat was just me trying to learn a synth. There's a synth in the software we used the whole time was Ableton.
Mm-hmm.
Still very good to this day. But that was like Ableton 3 and we're Ableton 9 now.
Mm-hmm.
But they released a synth called Operator, which is like a kind of late 80s, early 90s frequency modulated synthesizer.
Wow.
And I was just trying to learn how to make sounds with it.
Yeah. You know?
And I just turned it up and it did that ching, tong, tong noise. And I was like, okay. And then tweaked. And then there was a whole song there in the space of a couple of hours. And like we always say, it was written in a few hours. And it literally was.
Yeah.
I sent it to you. You sent it back and it was done.
It was done.
And then I spent 6 weeks trying to learn how to mix.
And then again, we sent one copy to John Kennedy. We then sent more out, but it was John that... It still annoys me a little bit to this day that...
John doesn't get the credit.
That he didn't let us fucking know he was going to play it, because I didn't get to hear our first bit of airplay.
I thought
that's how it worked. I thought you sent something. They went, I would like to play that. I will be playing it. And obviously, that's not how it works. They don't even... You can find it anywhere and play. I've now done a radio show and not told anyone about any of the shit I'm playing, but it was a shame at the time that I was like, oh, man,
to the extent that, like, someone played them... Edith Bowman... played a Portishead track the other day.
Yeah.
That I don't know who she works for now. Is it Absolute? Right. One of those. It's not BBC.
Maybe Absolute. Maybe not.
And Virgin.
Virgin, of course she does.
It. And they played an illegal leak of the track.
Brilliant.
It's just like, so you're not even going to tell the artist you're playing it, and B, you're going to play it illegally.
I had Danny Brown on the beatdown, and I played a track that I'd found on a blog that morning. that was his, and I was like, oh, I've got your new track, blah blah blah. I was like, what? And I was like, oh, this is like, so what's it called? And I'm like, this is like, he'd never heard it. He then went on to reveal, and this is one of my favorite lines ever. He was like, oh yeah, he's this guy, and I was around his house, we were barbecuing, drinking, smoking, doing rapper shit, which I just love, just doing rapper shit. And he was hammered and recorded this track and forgotten about it.
No way.
So I played it exclusively to him for the first time. Not only was it a worldwide radio exclusive, it was an exclusive to the guy who fucking wrote it and is on it. But yeah, that shows how little you get permission or clear stuff. But yes, so John played it, and very shortly after, Rob the Bank played it and started pushing it, and Zane Lowe got on board, and we kind of had...
It's funny, because Zane always gets the credit.
Yeah.
Of those three. And much love him, don't get me wrong, but he didn't. He wasn't.
He didn't play it first, but he took it to the audience. Zane had the power to take things to a new audience, which I was thinking this the other day, is there's not a Zane anymore. And that sounds harsh, because there's still Hugh, who's fucking amazing and killing it. But Zane, for some reason, his show had that weird audience that could be metalers or anything, yet they'd take whatever he fed them, essentially, a lot of the time.
7 o'clock starts, so you still had commercial listeners on, and had the more obscure listeners getting on for the evening.
Yeah.
Because that's what, when you think of where Hugh's show used to be, that was meant as the indie, and by indie I mean like DIY slot.
Yeah.
You know, obviously his personality allows him to do... Yeah. Full-on commercial stuff, because he's just one of just the loveliest lovely. Human just beings lovable. On the planet.
Oh, when I had him on the podcast, my favourite part was learning that as a kid he was a magician, and he's Welsh, and he had the magician name of Houdini. Which is the perfect name for a Welsh magician. I want him to go back to being a magician immediately, because Houdini is just absolute... Oh, I love it. God bless you, Stevens.
Yeah. It's all... really weird, isn't it? And then we got Mike Salmon, so Mike Cracked.
Yeah.
Or Mike Rack, or I think occasionally he's known as Mickey the Fish nowadays. Oh. Mickey the Fish. But he, obviously, he's like, you know, he was working in music. He was distributing for a really shady vinyl distributor. Like, really shady. Yeah, I shouldn't go into how shady, but so shady.
Let's keep the shady in the same.
But, like, he had kind of... He knew a director.
I was going to say, that's an absolutely key point, is Nick Frew.
Nick Frew,
and yeah. Through Mike and
yeah, and Mike had just been talking to him about... He had this group of people who he wanted to do a music video with, and they hadn't... They didn't know what they wanted to do, and Mike showed him the track, and Nick was excited, and then...
I've never seen Nick not excited. He's a lovable, he's excitable a
very
guy.
Exciting man.
But that was a beautiful thing, because he did have this team of just creative people.
Well, this is...
Tons of it was filmed in, like, squat-type places that people were staying in and all that, and they just built these amazing sets and all this. And it was 200 quid, wasn't it?
200 quid.
It was 200 quid.
That was 200.
And they just did amazing things with it.
The X Factor spoof was 186.
That's right, because they shot that and did, and made all of that for us. And then they
like a grand or something.
I think the Beat 'Em Arse was a grand.
Because we wanted to actually pay them, and we had a label who would pay for it.
Who would pay for it at that point. And and they did all of them. They did the Look for the Woman video, which again, there's a scene in that, which is my absolute favourite, and it doesn't stand out at all, but I loved it because of, again, it was that whole low budget thing of where the girl in it, is it the girl? Yeah, the girl is walking along and I'm stood in the doorway and then I go out of shot, and as they come around the corner, I'm then stood on the corner.
Yeah.
And the fact is on that, I had to climb over two fences with angel wings on in a suit and run, and I stood on the corner just looking casual. I was totally out of breath because as soon as I was out of shot, it was like, go! Because it was behind camera jumping over stuff. And that's what was amazing about Nick Frew and all of his two. There was a guy, Henry,
who never wore pants. That video.
Why?
Because, like, shooting the bit where I appear on the TV screen, it's just me and Nick in a room.
Oh, shit,
dark room. And I'm just singing that over and over again. I end up proper bawling, man.
Oh, wow.
Proper blobbing. It was one of those. And we hugged. And it was emotional.
Yeah.
And all that. But, yeah, good to cry.
But the video was absolutely key, because that's what got us an audience all over the world, kind of thing, it felt.
Yeah,
the video on MySpace was why...
It was before YouTube was shit.
Yeah, and within our first year, really, we got to play in Europe, in America, and Japan was probably within the first year, wasn't it? Was it 2008? So, yeah, within a year and a half, really, of all that...
2009, maybe, but I don't know.
Of all that kicking off, and we were up for an MTV award in Japan, which I always forget, but we were up for an MTV Music Award, which we were never there for, and never, I'm sure we didn't know about until after it had happened. It was like, here's your nomination in Best Dance Video or something. Yeah. It was like,
what?
Oh, really? Shit.
Yeah. But, like, the Thou Shalt video, like, is a reflection of shit we did throughout our entire career, and that was... this thing of finding passionate people and finding people. We very rarely went to a big company to get something done.
Yeah.
We found someone where us giving them the money to do it actually benefited them.
Because they wanted to do it. And again, it's also, as you said, as soon as we had budgets, it was like, right, we can spend some money on you now and pay people and do that. And that's kind of the beauty of... There's obviously often a lot of debate of people asking for anything for free. You know, it's such a weird area. When I had Amanda Palmer on the podcast, it was just after she had tons of shit because she'd asked if there were any string orchestras who wanted to come and play with her.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't paying them. It was all this, well, everyone has their fees and all this, which is fair. But equally, I think you shouldn't shame people if they want to do something and it's a creative... adventure. We weren't making anything from it either at the time, and all this, we were losing money at gigs and trying our best to break even. Early gigs, are there any that jump out to you or you remember? Because I struggle. I remember a couple in Reading.
Reading ones I remember more because I generally promoted them.
You put them on and made them happen.
So I was fucking working my ass off.
Yeah, but we knocked about a lot and did at the Social with Adele and Jack Pignatti.
Yeah.
That's a crazy...
We did a couple of those for John as well, which was rad.
Let's talk about touring with Mark Ronson, because that often gets forgotten and pushed under. He was amazing, because he asked us to and supported us and gave us a good push and was all over
it. It's weird, actually. If you email him, he responds.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't emailed him in a few years, but I'm assuming he still would respond.
Yeah.
Like, he had a huge amount of success, but there was no fucking, well, you can't talk to me now.
There's that was the cool thing, was...
Never felt there was any pretension.
He came along to our album launch drinks at 93 Feet East.
He did, yeah.
And it was only a few of us and mates, and we'd mentioned it to him.
Yeah.
And I think he was on his, genuinely, he was on his way to go and do something with Amy Winehouse.
Exactly.
And just stop by for a beer. And it's like, that's a fucking good dude there. Yeah. But that was a really good learning curve, because it was suddenly going, right, you've got a big audience there, but they're not there for you. And particularly when we came out, there was no one else like us. And I don't mean that in a we're amazing, but was no one else like us. It was a very odd thing. A big bearded man doing spoken word and you there kind of glitching things up and not having a guitar and drums and everything else.
We have to accept the fact that we had a far bigger career than we fucking should have.
Yeah, than anyone would have expected.
Like, write down what we are. Well, they kind of do electronic hip-hop, but it's not out and out dancey. It's not out and out hip-hop. And then there's a guy who he's gonna talk about suicide a bit, and like cutting yourself.
It will come up.
Also, massage. He's gonna rap about massage.
That massage track was a banger, man. On that first proper headline tour we had, when we took a living room.
They're gonna have a living room.
I did the massage track, and I nicked that coat thing from Slava from Slava's Snow Show, which I fucking adore. And it was just so much weird shit. Slava's
Snow Show was the name of his show.
Yeah, it's Slava's Snow Show. Yeah, he's Slava Pulinovic or something.
I thought Snow Show was a weird surname time.
But yes, but again, it was kind of dope, because quite early we were able to do a headline tour where we had a set and a stage, and we sold out.
We didn't have to have a set and a stage. We wanted a set and a stage.
But we could. I mean, that was kind of the important thing. And we bought it all from charity shops. I went shopping with Jim, and we loaded the van up with like a living room cabinet.
There was a fucking TV. A giant TV, man.
A TV which we wired up to have stuff come onto, didn't we?
There was a camera. We got a little radio transmitter and like an RF converter thing.
And Soundman Jim just built all of that and knocked it out weird, didn't he?
And we had a tiny little camera on
a lamp on my desk.
Yeah. That was funny, man.
And yeah, so that was all kind of...
That was for Tommy Cooper.
Yeah.
Tommy C.
And again, a lot of the stuff that I got credit for early on performance-wise, because for that one I went behind the desk as if I was a newsreader and did that. Yeah. It's because our career was happening so quick, I didn't have time to learn the lyrics.
And
Thou Shalt, like having the big book, it's because Thou Shalt got big, and because it's not a narrative or it's a load of things, it's really hard to remember what order that'd be in and things like that.
Yeah.
As odd as it sounds if you know the song well, but when no one knew the song well, it's a tough thing to get that. It's easier if it's, here's a story, it's going to go in this order, it makes sense.
I
so
still don't know it.
The reason I had the big Bible was because I didn't know it. The reason I sat behind the desk for Tommy C was and pretended to be a news reporter and have papers in front of me was because I had the
fucking
lyrics in front of me. A letter from God to man, I'll get a letter out. I'm reading the lyrics. All of this creativity was like, shit, our career's happening and we've got this fan base who want a certain thing, but we didn't have the money to go, right, we're going to spend 3 months in a studio practicing. It was like, no, we need to take the gigs and work hard and do the gigs.
That's why I early on in our career. I got really fat in those first couple of years. It's because I had to wear bigger and bigger t-shirts so you could have all the lyrics on the back.
Just covering out.
Yeah. Oh, I got so
fat. But that was like the first tour that, and again, we must have done the Scala, I guess, on that one as our first London Scala. Big headline. And that's a big venue to kick things off at. I remember the one in Reading because someone brought a toilet along.
They did,
At the Reading Arts Centre, wasn't it? Is it called
South Street Arts Centre?
The South Street Arts Centre, that's right. And again, the thing on that tour was we built a living room with a lampshade and a coat rack and
TV
and cabinets and an armchair. And one of the things we had was like an ornaments cabinet. We kind of said, look, bring ornaments along and we'll pop them in the cabinet. So by the end of the tour, we'll have a load of ornaments and it'll be all lovely. And at Reading, someone decided to bring
a toilet
along, an actual porcelain toilet, which we didn't make it into the van.
We left it on the street. I always feel bad about that.
Flight it that.
It was there for fucking months, though. Because I used to go to South Street Art Centre a lot, and I was really glad we did the show there.
Yeah.
Because although it's council owned, They were good people, man. Yeah.
And it was a conscious really choice. Like, we hit them up and requested that, we said to our agent we wanted to play there.
The Fez, and it would have been fine. But it's all about good people, man.
Yeah.
If you get to support good people in some way, shape, or form, then you do, man. It's ridiculous not to.
It's wise. It's a handy thing.
But that toilet was there for fucking ages. And, like, eventually someone broke it.
Yeah.
But then the broken bits of that... and I'd feel guilty. At the same time, it was really good. Every time I walked past it.
Yeah.
That weirdness.
That's our toilet. And it's weird, because that first album, no rhyme or reason or planning on the release. The first two singles were with Lex. Yep. So Thou Shout and Beat Them Heart Skip were on Lex Records, and we got this beautiful artwork done.
It's funny, actually, because, like...
We teamed up with Jock Mooney through them.
The reason... Beat That My Heart Skipped has a break in the middle is because of Lex. It's because they like pushed it, and you didn't want to. You wanted
they said
to just
that
have it.
I was just too relentless. They said people need a break because that's really long and fast at the start. It's just words. There's no gap. There's just words.
And
I was reluctant, but Will pushed it,
and I was cowardly. I was in that place of like, oh, they're a record label.
Yeah,
they know things.
Yeah.
So I did it, and then eventually you were happy.
It was right. It was spot on. Because originally it was that intro just went straight into the verse, but then we turned the intro to go into the chorus and then have a bit of a breath. But yeah, so we did that, and then we're talking to tons of big labels. We talked to Warner. And who were the ones that Kate Nash was on?
Oh, it was Regal.
Regal.
Parlophone.
Parlophone.
So Regal was the Salvation Army record label.
There you go.
And they relaunched the label with Kate Nash.
Yeah.
Because she is our salvation.
She is.
Basically. So that was Parlophone. And I always find it funny because, like, we met Nigel Coxon, who was, like, the big boy.
Yeah.
And I was reading... fuck is that book? And what's that guy's name? He wrote a book about the record industry.
I've no idea.
Fuck! It's a good book, man. It's murder. I think Peg is in the film of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. How to make friends and influence people?
Yeah.
Is that the book?
So what's his name?
No, that might not be the book.
Fuck it. Niven? It's not Niven, is
Niven.
It?
Niven. John Niven. John Niven.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he gets referenced in that book.
Yeah.
And it was always weird, like, oh,
he's great, John Niven. I think he hates me. I'm not certain. I know he hated, like, when Ricky Hall was getting all that hate because he said some stupid stuff.
Did he?
He's adorable, but the sun jumped on him because he did some interview. And it was a little while after I'd had him on the podcast, and when there was everyone was like, he's the devil, he's the epitome of Zoolander, he's the ultimate hipster and all this. I was like, have a listen to the podcast, because I talked to him for 90 minutes, and he's just a nice boy. He's not necessarily Einstein, but he's just a nice boy.
So what did he say?
In the interview, they asked him where he gets his influence from, and he said, I end up taking my influence from anywhere, from children to catwalks to homeless people. And the homeless people line. It's not the best line, is it? I take influence from...
If he'd said the street.
Yeah. But he said homeless people. And people were then like, that sounds like a Zoolander thing. It's disrespectful and all this. So he got shit on. And I think I was tweeting at the time about just saying, look, if you want to think that, but have a listen to this. And I think... I can't remember what it was. Something happened on Twitter at that point that Niven was
using
like...
Using a news story to get... podcast listens all
fucking always, mate.
Shut all out.
But that's it. I think it was more that Niven felt I was a fellow ultimate hipster. I'm not certain. I can't even remember. There was some kind of tweet because I follow him because I think he's funny as fuck. But yeah, anyway, that's kind of gone off on a tangent. But we met a load of people, and we met someone at Warner. And we met the boss man there, because Warner was the one we came closest to, because they put an offer in and we were kind of all right with it.
It was decent money.
And then it was good money, and then we met the guy, and he'd just got back from a meeting with Linkin Park, I think it was.
He had, no.
And I remember thinking, oh,
There was,
he was all hyped
he's
about
17.
It. No, because that was it. No, when we that met him, it was a meeting with Linkin Park, and then there was a documentary about E17, and he was the one that signed them to make their comeback.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was all that.
It was the Gallows. It wasn't Linkin. It was the Gallows.
No, they'd signed the Gallows, and that's what had got us on board. That it definitely met with someone in America. But yeah, they threw a fuckload of money at Gallows, which was a crazy choice at the time for the music that they were making.
The music industry's fucking renegade at that time. Some, cause
it's when Hadouken had got a ton of money, isn't it? And loads of people.
Well, like, the amount of conversations we would have, we were lucky to meet a lot of those big labels.
Yeah.
But it also, there was knowing the amounts of money some acts that did one album then vanished got is why the industry is fucked. Like, it's the one thing, like, I'm really glad of.
Yeah.
We took a deal that was not even a tenth of what we could have taken from Warner, and we got a decade out of it.
Well, we were getting offered over 100 grand, wasn't it? I can't remember the exact numbers, but again...
And we took... you know...
But that was the thing. We kind of... We had a few different labels all talking. We had... Market Universal was absolutely lovely and on the publishing front.
Yeah.
And Simon at Sony, I think it was, on the publishing as well at the same time, were both like, really, they got it. And it, that was the really interesting thing for me, was we met a load of majors and a load of independents.
Yeah.
And I expected all the independents to get it and all the majors to not.
And not.
And it wasn't the case.
Yeah.
Some of the independents were like, we want this to be the next Kano or something like that. And it's like, I think Kano's the bollocks, but that this isn't what this is. And it was, there was kind of some weird things, and it was weird that a few of the huge ones that we met were like, and the reference in that song that's to an Eric B and Rakim song, or things like that. Yeah. It was like, oh shit, it wasn't that,
so
that
funny,
easy thing.
I remember every time you bring someone up, I remember who that was.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, that guy. Yeah,
I remember a meeting, like when we were in XL with Richard Russell.
Yeah.
And they were saying, he said in the first meeting, and again, he won't mind, I'm sure. I'm naming all names. I don't care anymore.
Name drop.
I'm a podcaster now. I went in a meeting with Richard Russell, and he was like, so, Dan Lissac versus Scroobius Pip, though, is that going to work? Why wouldn't we just go with a rapper name, or why wouldn't the rap be first, or whatever? And it was brilliant, because I got to just point behind him, as he had a massive frame poster of Eric B. and Rakim, and it was like, there you go.
We could have done that.
And that kind of went, all
that's
right.
That's the thing, man. That was the sticking point on them offering. They would have offered if we'd have agreed to Scroobius Pip.
Yeah.
And I fucking left it up to you. And I'm grateful.
It was, I said it felt, and again, I don't think it was them being dicks in any way. But at that point, they had Jack Pignatti, who wrote with a band, but it was Jack Pignatti. They had Adele, who wrote again.
In a sense, they were right. We have a shit name.
We've got a terrible name. It was a MySpace name. But yeah, it was. I can't remember. I'm loath to say it was a done deal if we'd gone with Scroobius Pip. But it was certainly one of the bits that we were sticking on and discussing, and we kind of went, look,
that
it's Dan Lissac versus Scroobius Pip.
Obviously, we only had a manager for that brief time.
Yeah.
Until later on, until Rebecca came on and just did everything
kicked us
for
into
us.
Line.
He made it appear as if it was a done deal.
Yeah.
But like, he would have gained from that deal, because he would have got money from that deal.
So, but yeah, so we were talking to a lot of people with a lot of money floating about, and one of the people that we were going back to get advice on different contracts and offers was Rob the Bank. I remember specifically going, well, Warner are saying this, is this a good deal?
Yeah.
And kind of, we were going to him for advice on this, and it was at that point we kind of went, well, let's just go with Rob the Bank and go with somebody best, right?
Yeah, so I was still working at that big place in Waterloo.
Yeah.
And I snuck off. I'd arranged to talk to Robbie's manager. And when you say manager, everyone thinks evil manager. But Robbie's manager is his best mate, like, on this planet.
Yeah.
Someone who will support him, you know, walk through fire for Robbie. Yeah. So Ben Turner.
Yeah.
And Ben sat on the phone, and we just had a chat about all this stuff. And, like, I think I sort of said, well, you know, I'd rather do it with you lot. And I don't think that it even crossed their mind at that point.
Yeah.
Or
because at that point they hadn't really signed proper acts. They kind of put some remixes out and stuff like that. And
yeah,
we were
done a lot of,
not to be deep, but we were the band that kind of launched them as a label more.
They'd done, not to put Dub Grandiose Pistols.
Yeah,
like I think, I don't know if that was their first album. I don't know. They hadn't done,
but
a
Dub Pistols
vast
again at that point weren't as much of a band as they are now. They were more of a DJing thing as well, and all this kind of thing, a remix.
But like, so I don't think it crossed their mind to do it, and.
And again, in respect, I mean, we're standing here saying how we took a lot less than we could have got. They also were like, right, are we going to now be a label? Do you know what I mean? Is a big risk on a risk on both parts, I guess, is all I'm trying to say.
You think
it's not like we did them this great favour of allowing them the grace of releasing our music.
And they
for three,
they did us a great favour of fucking investing.
Yeah.
You know, they wrangled with a distributor to get... They took a worse deal off a distributor to get... more money to actually promote
to spend on
the
it,
fucking record, you know.
And we had a fucking billboard, didn't we?
We had a billboard.
A couple of them. Or was it only one? There was definitely one in Shoreditch. In
I never
London.
Saw it.
I saw a picture
we had a
of
billboard.
It. Yeah. We had a fucking billboard up, mate.
I know.
It's crazy.
But that's the thing, like, again, it comes back to that people working together to get something done instead of it being machines.
Yeah.
You know.
So yeah, that
I always
kind
find
of,
that fascinating as well. Like, I wear it as a badge of pride that we chose the right label over the right amount of money.
Yeah,
I would. My life would be different now. I would own my own home if we'd gone a different way.
Yeah.
You know, but I'd own my own home if I'd worked as hard as you have. You've worked harder than me. I accept that.
It's tough. It's different.
I'm also cooler and a better lover.
It's different.
So, you know.
It's different areas, isn't it? But because I'd definitely say for a lot of our, particularly when we were a managerless, there was a big split, or we were both aware of what our strengths were. You know, I mean, there was a lot, particularly just music industry stuff that you knew way better than me.
Yeah.
And I'd kind of like, as long as you were okay with doing that, as long as it didn't feel as if I was saying, oh, you deal with all that. It was like, as long as you were all right with it, I was like, well, you know what you're doing now. I haven't got a fucking clue what they're talking about. So
no, yeah, and it's that thing of like the way my brain works. I pick this stuff up in really quick. I can't write a whole song of lyrics, but you know, as soon as someone puts a contract in front of me, I can read it and go
through it all.
That means that. Okay. Oh wait a minute, they get off children.
Yeah.
Shit. No, we don't want this one.
Let's avoid that one.
But like, yeah. So I definitely. Definitely feel like I worked for the band.
Yeah.
And, like, there were occasional times where I'd feel like, in that early time when we were recording the record, but you were still doing Scroobius Pip stuff.
Yeah.
I did quotation marks in the air. Just
you did,
so you
I
know.
Saw him.
I did them. I would resent it sometimes, because I'd feel like, well, I'm fucking working, and you're not. But you are working, because what it took me a long time to realise that everything comes back to this. Neither of us have a...
I mean, in
reality, neither of us... This podcast exists because of Dan and Pip.
Yeah, completely. Like,
and it doesn't.
No, it does. But just in every way as well. Not even only in a... If I'm off building my name, it adds to our name.
Exactly.
But in just experience as well, because I always felt, and as I've said to you numerous times, and we won't go into it in huge detail, but we'll touch on it, the EP you did with Kid A, I think is some of your best production, as I've told you a million times, which is weird as someone who's worked with you on loads of tracks. My favourite Dan Lesak produced track is Trampled Youth, which I think is amazing. I think it's such a good track. I regularly apply it to people. It's always on my phone. I've got that one in particular on my phone. But again, that kind of thing, it's going off and getting experience and working with someone who isn't me, who isn't just me rambling over tracks and things like that, and developing
that whole Kid
you
A
as a producer.
EP
and,
was like me and her were bouncing tracks back and forth over the internet for a while. We'd met some PR guy at Sankey's Soap in Manchester.
Yeah.
And he had just got into management and he had this new act and he wanted a producer. And me and her just emailed back and forth like me and you did.
Yeah.
Traded ideas, but it ended up like she came to the UK. I convinced the
Cooper. She also sung on Cauliflower. She, I mean, we should highlight that as yeah, well. Yeah. So anyone who's thinking, who the fuck is this bitch Kid they're A. talking about? Yeah. But yeah.
Who is this girl?
Yeah.
But so I convinced the Cooper Temple Claws, who are Reading boys yep. and lovely human beings. Tom from Coopers is in a band with Eddie Temple Morris yep. these days called Losers. The Losers. Yep. I think they're still doing that.
Yep.
But like convinced them to let me use their studio, which Tom after the Coopers had on his own.
Yeah.
And it was just like learning.
Yeah.
Like 4 days, 5 days in a studio learning, recording that EP, like learning how to mic drums for the first
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
I was, there's a track I play piano on.
Yeah.
And like, it was weird sitting in the room behind glass, like with people on the other side watching me play piano and like, hang on, I've never actually done this because yeah. everything else had been in my house.
In your house, on your own.
I still...
No one watching, no pressure.
Yeah, man. I rarely put trousers on. Trousers on.
I mean, you've not got trousers on now.
I haven't, yeah, I know. Sorry, my penis keeps winking.
No, it's fine. I never apologise.
It's like a little guppy out of water.
But yeah, so yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah, I think that even in a way of anything you do outside is bringing to the project in a literal way, audience-wise, it's bringing into it a creative a way as well. And I always remember being excited to hear that record because it was like, right, fuck, that sounds that you would never have made with me in mind as such. And it did influence stuff down the line because You Will See Me in the end was a track that I said to you was, that trample, I'm still in love with that track. Can you make something that's not the same but on the similar slow build and buzz? And that's kind of how this that came.
This kind of throws back a little to the new record.
Yeah.
Because the reason it's called Cherished Overthrown is there are these things that I poured love into but then got pushed out of the way because either they weren't suitable for me and you.
Yeah.
Or I was pulled away from them by what we were doing or working with Dolan or, you know. So it's kind of like I don't think that I've ever had a sound. Yeah, I do clearly have a sound.
100%.
But because I don't think I've got a sound, I allow myself to go wherever I want, you know. There's a track on that, on the new one called Crom, that for a brief time had B. Dolan and Mike Ladd on it, two of my fucking favourite rappers of all time, but ended up getting pushed away for something else because of time, because of whatever.
Yeah.
And finally getting that time to come back to it and do it and finish it and make it the thing I wanted it to be. And that's the thing about the Kid A EP. There was sounds that I didn't know I could, either didn't know I could make or didn't think would fit what we're doing.
And that's what I really liked about this new record is this is going to sound like a really weird statement, but they all sound complete and they all sound finished. It's not got vocals on it. Or it's got some sampled vocals on and some bits like that.
Yeah.
But it's not a verse. It's not a vocal-led record in any way. Yeah, there's no lead vocals in it
That was like...
There's vocals as an instrument. There's vocals as a bedding. There's vocals as numerous different things.
I could do that without Repent, Replenish, Repeat.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Something like that.
The Pirate record.
Yeah.
Right, because that record was the point at which I got the fucking balls to be confident in a melody.
Mm-hmm.
You listen to You Will See Me.
Yeah.
It's simple and it's led by that melody.
Yeah.
You go back and I would lead everything by drums.
Yeah.
Like, heavy.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And I love programming drums, man. I love chopping up breaks and all that. And like DJ Shadow, what he has done in his career is take something and repurpose, reignite a fire, find the core soul of a break and turn it into something. And that was like a huge inspiration on me.
Yeah.
But the music I love is fucking Joy Division and New Order.
And
the melodies.
Yeah.
So important.
Yeah.
And but that's why it's taken me so long to fucking finish the new record because.
But that was it.
It didn't feel that
it's missing vocals, if you know what I mean. Exactly. And that was exactly that. It's got that. Yeah. It's like, right, this isn't this, that's that. It didn't.
They're not meant to be there.
How was it, and this might be a weird one now, how was it sending me stuff? Because our way of working was you'd send me a fuckload of beats, I'd take a walk and listen, and come back crazy excited about two, three things, but crazy excited and not thinking about the fact that I've then probably ignored 80. 5 or 6 things or 80 things or however many things. So it's a weird, it's a weird thing. But before, the fact that you're sending 30 or so over means obviously you're aware that they're not all going to be used and come back. So it's a weird situation that's always going to have some kind of, I thought that one was the bollocks and it's been completely ignored.
Yeah, well, like,
but so much of it can be on a moment, on that thing of, I heard this one and that's all I care about now. You know?
Stanley's the best example of that because you got 88. Stanley was in 88 beats. Because I didn't know if we were doing another record at that point. Like, because you had done...
I've done Distraction Pieces.
That's what it, Distraction Pieces.
Which, interestingly, I was going to mention then, of you saying you didn't feel you had a sound, the first two or three beats that Danny Lona sent me, who's Nine Inch Nails and everything else amazing, would just Dan Lissac beats. I was like, you're just making Dan Lissac beats. He's like, yeah, but I love Dan Lissac beats. And he's like, he's into your sound. I was like, I don't want to do a record that me and Dan could do. Otherwise, the point of doing a solo record was to do a record that couldn't do. Similar with the Kid A thing. It was when, like, I heard that and thought, that's something we couldn't have done. So that's dope.
When Interdiction came out, like, I couldn't be jealous.
Yeah, I
was so fucking relieved, man. Because that blew up. That
wouldn't have happened from us as well.
But it couldn't have been me. Mm. And I was like, thank fuck for that. Because if it could have been me, I would have been pissing.
Man.
Yeah.
Like, why wasn't that over one of our tracks?
But it couldn't.
Yeah.
It was like, nice. Can you remind me? I've never done it, but I need to record the remix of that.
Because we were doing a live remix of that.
Because I said years ago I'd give it to Danny, and I never did.
It's a banger.
Sorry, making notes in the podcast.
Where were we?
Doesn't remind me. Whoever's listening, can you tweet me, Dan, to do that?
You're going
to
regret that, man. On one podcast in the intro, I said, like, oh, this is everyone, how are you today? Or something like that. I said, and tweet me, because then I'll just get it and I won't know what it is. I still get tweets just out of the blue going, I'm just at the supermarket. Who the fuck's this? And it will twig that it's someone who's listened to that. So yeah, anytime you listen to this, tweet Dan reminding him to send that to Danny Lona. So what were we up to there? We were up to Stunner, because you sent that with a load of tracks. I was going to say, and I was thinking this on the way over, and I was thinking about, as I always say for years, that Trampled Youth is my favourite track that Dan Lissac produced track. I always said that until you sent me Stunner, and that took it. Because when that beat, I remember I told you at the time, I emailed Zane Lowe. I didn't send him anything, just emailed and say, dude, there's a track coming. I don't know when, and it was about a year later. I don't know when, but you're going to fucking... Because I knew that he'd love it as well. It was one of them beats that I was like, fuck, that's the one. Stunner was in a load.
Stunner is fucking DJ Shadow.
Right.
You can't hear it, but it's inspiration.
Yeah.
Like... He, in the way he uses samplers and gating, like me interpreting. It's a translation of something I learned from listening to someone else.
Yeah, but you had a point on that Stunner was in a collection of 80 odd beats.
You asked how it would feel to
pull
your heart out into a vast body of work and then screw his pip.
I like these two
songs from it. Right. Stunner, the reason being is I never thought you would pick Stunner in my entire life. I was fucking immensely proud of that. And at that point when you heard it was a minute and a half long. And I chucked it in on a whim. I thought, man, he's not going to dig it, but, you know.
Yeah.
So instead of being ever, like, pissy that you hadn't reacted to... There was a track that I still think... like either you or Dolan would smash called Last Days. Just piano and a break, that's it. But it's fucking lovely. And instead of being pissy that you didn't pick that, I was always like, he fucking picked Stunner.
You like that one?
I actually almost respect him now.
I was all over that. I was like, this is the one.
That's the point. It was like, it had to be right. And I don't think I was ever in the position to choose what was right.
And that was always the tough thing there, I guess, because particularly with in that instance, as said, we'd both gone off and done solo stuff and separate stuff, so we didn't know what sound we were going to go for.
I hadn't done Space Between the Words at that point, had I? That was after.
No, you had.
I had.
Yeah, you had. So it was one of them. It was kind of a, right, here, it's the reason there was such a high number there, because there was a huge range of sounds and styles and things. It was like
Long Night of Life on Space Between the Words was originally for Dolan.
Yeah.
He loved it, but he never did anything, so I took it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Space Between the Words is a weird thing for me, because so many more people told me that was a good record than ever told me about our records being good. Yet no one bought it.
Yeah.
literally.
And
I'm surprised. But, I'll be surprised if you sold like 2,000 copies, which is amazing.
I was going to say, do you think your perception of that is because of being tied into a label for it, and then there's that weird expectation and pressure? Because the fact is, most people listening now will go, man, imagine selling 2,000 records.
I know.
And even I would say that now, completely, on actually releasing a record. It's like, it's fucking, people don't buy shit.
At all.
Yeah, that's great news if you shift 2,000. But it's that weird thing of being tied in and having having blown up in just that bit before it all dropped off.
But we had to.
So our big records had sold a fuckload, and then we were just in that period where people stopped paying for shit.
But it's that thing of selling 2,000 after you sold a multitude more than that.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think, like, emotionally, Space Between the Words knocked me a lot.
Yeah.
Like, a huge amount. And I think I'd be a very different person if we hadn't done Repent, Replenish, Repeat.
Yeah.
Not because of sales, because of, like, realigning my understanding of music creation.
Completely. I think Repent was... It's still the one that I pick as my most proud work, which is great, because it's the most recent and it should be.
I think I'm... Yeah.
But, I'm, yeah.
Like... As a complete piece, I think making, what is it, 9 tracks?
Yeah.
I think cutting it down to the core, there's no fluff. Logic of Chance has a little bit too much fluff on it.
Yeah.
It's a bit too clean in its sound. Yeah, it still has 5 minutes on it, and it still has inert explosions on it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and, like, yeah. This thing, man, like... On a psychological level, on an emotional level, I don't know how I would be without Rrr.
Yeah.
Because Rrr felt like we got it right.
Yeah.
And we can walk away.
But equally, it couldn't have happened without everything else. It wouldn't have happened. Repent wouldn't be Repent if we hadn't both done solo records. Gone off and worked with other people, seen what works, seen what doesn't work, done everything, and then come back and gone.
I was so hungry after Space Between the Words, because I felt like I proved myself on Space.
Yeah.
And no one else did.
Yeah.
So I was like, I have to now prove myself. And I feel like, that... Everything after Repent doesn't matter.
Yeah.
In like, I have my badge. Yeah. I got the scout badge of producing a perfect record.
Yeah.
Even though it's nothing you ever do is perfect. Yeah. You know what I mean? So for the rest of my days,
knowing that's the best we could have done, and because that was the interesting thing. And let's get on to, I touched on the last one that we'd talk about, a label stuff and all that. The whole difficult second record. I'm not a believer in it. I think I'm really pleased with Logic of Chance. I think, as said, things like Sick Tonight are 5 minutes and Explosions, as you said, and Cauliflower still was one of my favourite to perform live.
Not a bad track on it.
No,
there's not anything wrong with the record.
Yeah,
it's just not.
I mean, there's one on every record. There's normally one that I'm not happy with. Lyrically about a day after it comes out.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Burn that fucking song in.
God damn that song.
I was in, right, okay, I'm fucking in this cab in Boston a few weeks ago. I met a streamer I fucking admire, a great guy, this guy called Richard Hammer.
Yeah.
You know, and he's sitting in the back of the cab and...
From Top Gear.
From,
So it's because it's like Richard Hammond. That's right, that's why that's funny.
He's sitting in the back of the cab. And he asks the people I'm with, what's the song he hates the most? And then I fucking hear it back from hell from a mobile phone.
Brilliant.
Distorting us. Brilliant. Just like, yeah, fucking hate
it. It's not our best moment, man. But it's popular as well. The kids dig it.
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that thing of that's only on angles because people liked it.
Yeah.
And
That's a good thing sometimes. That's a good thing sometimes. Yeah, and again, I think that it's on Logic of Chance, it felt
the
that
definition of selling out is doing something
other
than what you believe because somebody else.
But that's it. It's tough, isn't it? Because when we wrote it, we believed in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's not like we're like, oh, we need to write a song like this. We wrote it, it was like, this is good, and then it got popular and we got sick of it. And then it's like, oh, fuck.
It's like, sometimes selling out gets confused with compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think artists forget that they're not... It's just it wasn't just me and you.
Yeah.
It was me, you, and the fucking audience.
And that's what I thought with Logic of Chance. I thought that was our most... That was the album that we all compromised the most on.
Yeah.
And just weren't in the same headspace. I think there was certain tracks we cut that I liked and certain tracks we kept that I wasn't a fan of and vice versa. There were certain tracks I fought to keep on the record that you weren't into that maybe now look like weaker ones. And again, like vice versa. But
I still think Inert Explosions is the best beat I've ever written. No one else agrees.
I honestly couldn't tell you any of the lyrics to it.
No.
There's tons of songs like that.
Never done it live as
the ones we don't do live, it's like...
What's that song about?
No idea what... Like, as someone will send me a quote, I'll be like, that's a dope quote. We're like, oh, I wrote that. All right, I had no idea that's one of mine. But
someone tweeted the other day about, oh, the last 45 seconds of Last Train Home.
Yeah.
Beautiful electronic music. I was like,
really?
There's
an outro?
There's an outro? And I had to then go online.
Pip shut the fuck up for 45 seconds? No way. That can't have happened.
I packed that on without him knowing.
But as said, I think the thing that I found interesting with that record, looking back, and was a big lesson, was the order of singles. And Sunday Best were convinced that Get Better, which we were just mentioning songs on that record. And despite I had a love-hate thing with that, I felt at points it felt too soft and preachy. But
I thought Stake of Claim was the first song on that album.
You see, that's it. And,
me.
And they were keen for Get Better to be the first single. Well, I was keen for Sick Tonight to be the first single, because, I don't know, it felt like we're back. But both of us kind of wanted a harder one. Like, wanted a harder track to open with.
Yeah.
And then go, here's our... Which, again, Get Better. And again, particularly Alive. Man, Get Better is one of the best experiences I've had. Yeah. Of performing that live and seeing people going nuts.
Production
fields
on
of
Get
tens
Better
of thousands
not,
of people.
And this doesn't feel like my shiniest time. But I was trying to do something clean and uplifting, and I'm not a clean or uplifting person.
Well, that's what's kind of interesting for both of us on that track, is we were really stretching and pushing for something. I wanted to write a track for the kids that wasn't a preachy shit track for the kids, which is a fucking hard thing to do, and Nas has pulled it off, and Slick Rick has pulled it off, but Slick Rick pulled it off by being ironic about it and kind of making it a silly song for the kids.
Yeah.
And so that's what kind of, no matter how much I went off it and then got back into it and things like that, it's still one, because it's like, right, well, that means a lot, because we didn't just go, well, second album, let's make another list poem, another one that's beat of my heart, with a bit of fast rapping in and a good sung hook and things like that. So it felt like we had that, no, we're still trying to make interesting and unusual shit. But can we talk a little bit about, because it occurred to me on the way up here, it's one of the few songs, or the only song that we've ever made in that way, was a Cauliflower. Because that was one where, when we were making Angles, I was like, Velvet Morning. This track, Sun Velvet Morning. Nancy Sinatra and what's his name? I can't think of his name now.
Barry White.
No, similar.
Hazelwood.
Lee Hazelwood. And it's amazing, because for the guy's vocal, it's a one tempo, and for the girl's vocal, it's a different tempo. It's such a change, but it's so beautiful and dreamy. And I was obsessed with this. And it's the only time I've really come to you and said, here's the kind of beat I'd like. In general, you'll send me options, and I'll go, I'm feeling this direction, not that direction, and we'll
work in that way. I always felt disconnected from that track.
Yeah, because that's it. I know it's one that you've never felt that...
It just never...
That click to.
And, like, it's funny, because before Adele blew up, she was going to do the vocal.
She was, and she wrote some stuff for it that we
never
got to
sent
hear.
Us it.
But she had written stuff and was talking about it,
and
it was
Peggy Sue.
Yep,
with the pirates at that time. Even though there were never any pirates, they lied.
Peggy Sue and the Pirates.
They lied.
But they wrote some awful shit for it. And I love those girls. But I remember because they played a bit when we were touring, had them touring with us. And they had written like a... They would, at that point, were kind of singing Scroobius to the tune of Notorious. And it was a similar thing to that. I was like, that's not... Scroobius. And it's like, that's not really the thing we're going for. But maybe that's what made me love it so much, was it was such... Again, that whole album, there was a lot of songs on there then that were a long journey and weren't just these easy things. So that was one that went back and forth for ages, and you wrote the vocal really for Kid A and with Kid A and all this because you were working on that record at the time.
I wrote that vocal.
Yeah.
She... Not in a... I did it all. But I wrote that vocal out and out. I sang it. And then got her to sing
in the right part.
Because, like... It had to be done that way. I couldn't. Yeah. It was already somebody else's idea.
I had to stamp
it and all that.
Take that control.
Singing that high pitch, though, man.
Yeah.
So hard. But, like, Cauliflower's a really good example. Like, everyone talks about new. It's got to be new. It's got to be, you know, the pace at which the internet moves. Everything's about new. And it's like, some ideas take fucking time, man.
Yeah.
Like you with the acting.
Mm-hmm.
The acting comes out of you fucking starting to write screenplays 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and maybe some of those ideas will end up on the fucking silver screen.
Turn into something. Or
there's nothing wrong with...
A week or two ago, I've just finished a first draft of a novel. And again, it's a long way off, but it's the story I've told you about since college.
Yeah.
So that's literally 17, 18 years.
Exactly.
As you were saying with this new album, stuff that gets in the way, it's not like I've been sitting on my ass. It's not happened because we've suddenly got to tour the world and we've got to do this and do that. So,
but like it's people sometimes throw stuff away because it's older and artists do it. Peggy Sue are a great example.
Instantly came to mind because I love those girls and. And when they toured with us, I'm obsessed with New Song. It's still, I think, one of my favourite songs ever written. It's beautiful.
That remix of it as well.
I think it's amazing. Lovely. And then when they toured with us, they were playing all their new stuff. And I literally took them aside and said, just for me then, can you play New Song? Because they were running bands who, again, had gigged with Adele and Kate Nash and all us crowd at the time. And for me... Their early songs and their new songs were also fucking amazing, but their early songs were better than they had got the credit for yet.
Yeah.
I was like, you can't move on from that yet because not enough people have heard that fucking amazing song. More people need to hear that song before you go, bro, that's our old stuff. Like, we don't do it anymore.
Just because we've heard it a thousand times, it doesn't
not
mean
enough people
that,
have heard it. Or just because you've heard it a thousand times, and that's the thing that I just have to get in the head for. It's like, just because you've played it a lot, it doesn't mean anyone else has... It's got it. Yeah. Interesting one.
It's
though,
like
the
there's some songs like as an artist you can't not perform as well. How many times did we not perform Thou Shalt?
Yeah,
we like twice, did that three times,
pretty much every show. Yeah,
yeah, and like it's not because, thankfully, I never grew to hate it.
Yeah,
and it never felt shit.
No,
you know, and I fucked around with it. It had some crazy.
We
mutations.
Had some great versions. We had a hip hop karaoke version.
Hip hop karaoke around with it.
No, hip hop karaoke was at the end of Great Britain, wasn't it? We did that.
We did it in our show. Because the live recording of that on the 2007 Camden Crawl CD that I can see up there has the hip hop karaoke on it.
Right.
We had to license it off the BBC.
Yeah.
We had to pay the BBC money to use that.
Weird. And then we put early on, we put a live CD out. Was that before Angles? Our live CD that Laura Dockrell did the artwork for. It was a little drawing of us.
A five-track thing. Yeah. And it had... the bonus track was the mini-mix that Annie Mac...
Sweet.
And, like, everyone else who does a mini-mix, everyone else in the world who does a mini-mix does a mash-up of loads of songs.
Yeah.
I did a mash-up of loads of songs and then put... Beat My Heart Skips Over the Top.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Got to get the plug in.
The plug in. So, where have we gone? We've covered all three albums, really. Or let's end on the last album, I guess. On Repent, Replenish, repeat, because we'd both gone off and done solo records, and both, I think the most important part in my head is both worked with a load of other people, so learnt stuff that we liked, learnt stuff we didn't like, learnt what was good about us working together and what was bad about us working together, and it felt that on that record, it felt, for some reason, it felt like maybe the easiest to make, because we knew what our strengths were and what our weaknesses were, and where we'd rub each other up the wrong way and where we wouldn't. It kind of felt, well, we could just go, let's make this record. I know at this point I leave Dan to do that, and I don't get too involved because he knows what he's doing.
Space Between the Words taught me a lot. One of the things, it's a negative thing, but it taught me that some people are fucking assholes, and it's sad, but there were just some really difficult conversations on that album about fucking shit I didn't care about.
Yeah.
You know, there was no one on that record I didn't offer half the track to.
Yeah.
Because they were half the track. Me and you were 50-50. Why would I, you know, someone did say, no, I'm only 30. It's like, that's great. Yeah. You know, that's nice humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't get 30, he got 40. Talked him up. Yeah.
Good work.
But like, so some people are fucking grubby and greedy. And it did make me realize how balanced we'd kept it. You could have had more money. You were the pull for you are the front man. You are.
I was going to say, that's it. It's the one on the mic. That's why so many people, when I walk down the street, go, Dan Lesak.
Yeah.
Because it's that. Your name was at the front, but my face was at the front.
You directed the videos for that last album. You were a big selling point for the band. And I never... You never once diva'd it and
but it was
more. But you again, could have had more. That's the thing.
The thing that made it all work, though, I feel, again, was that we came back strong and in control as such. And I think Stunner was a great example of that, of... It wasn't like Get Better where it's this. And I learned that with Interdiction. Because Interdiction, if that wasn't me doing it on my own label, that wouldn't have been the opening single. Because it had no chorus. It had it's not. But then my thinking was, well, neither did Thou Shalt. And it's finding what you feel will go, this will let people know what's going on.
Yeah.
As the first single. And then, right, this might be the more commercial one, or this one's got Flux on, or whatever else. This could be the big pop hit, or this could be that, or whatever. But it felt that we could go, right, here's Stunner.
Gold Teeth's the only one that annoys me, but only because it should have been me dancing at the end of the video.
Yeah, not, I think you're right.
What's his face?
Aaron.
Yeah, I always feel like moves. That would have been, that video would have been better for
See, Gold Teeth is the sleeper hit there for me, as I forget that track a lot, but I rate it. I think it was really good. I think production-wise, on you and Flux, and you working with Flux, which I know was a nervous and exciting thing for you, because I remember at the time you being like, well, I knew you knew what you were doing, but everyone who's self-taught is worried that someone's going to go...
Exactly.
So if you sling a...
Oh, mate.
And say something you've never heard of on there, and you'll have to go, I don't know what that is.
I think one of the guiding principles of my entire life, whether it be work, romance, making dinner, is someone's going to find out that I don't know what I'm actually doing.
Yeah.
I'm always scared that someone's going to find out.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But then again, it all worked together beautifully. And as you said, it was interesting for me to have my traditional, I like the first version, or fall in love with the first version, because Flux did some great stuff on it, his first remix of it, and I was like, No, I don't like it.
It was a weird process, because like...
So it was going back three ways, kind of back to you, back to him, back to me.
And ultimately, it came down to me.
Yeah.
It had to be that. And we did it right, man. And Flux did great on it.
Yeah.
And he didn't just turn it into a Flux record. He showed...
Exactly that.
...intelligence and sensitivity to the material and stuff. And those strings he did are rad, man.
Yeah.
I think. But it's fucking track doesn't actually get as much love as I think it should have.
Because of Stunner and You Will See Me being such
so big,
just video wise,
award winning.
You Will See Me, and just
I think
the videos for them both nailed it really well and got the emotion, and they're very relatable because they're about relationships. So
yeah.
I think they're the two that people remember a lot from Repent, whereas I said I always forget Gold Teeth, and then I'm like, fuck, that was it's a banger.
It was a monster.
Humbly.
But that's the thing, man. It's all a journey. it's all these little moments, yeah. little vignettes of your creative state at the time, yeah. you know.
And there's no path or you can't or there's no cheat or rule to it all. As even in this conversation, you've seen the thing that always gets me with You Will See Me is it was another one where the album was finished at that point.
Yeah,
like we'd finished the record, and then I kind of had this idea and had said.
You
like
see,
you never sent me one that was kind of like that Kid A track and all this.
Yeah,
and it was another one again. You sent that, and I wrote the vocal, and emailed it back pretty much immediately. I think the first verse at least, because I was literally you emailed it. I'd emailed you about it, or we'd been talking about it, and you emailed it over, and I'd started to write this idea, and I was about to go out to lunch with my mum, and I thought. He'll email it, I'll come back and I'll listen to it. But it came about 10 minutes before I went. So I literally recorded it into the laptop mic and sent it and then went to lunch. It was that quick, that hugely... Mm. Again, it's another one similar to Thou Shalt, which is kind of beautiful that Thou Shalt was the first song we wrote and one of the biggest and was written in a couple of hours. My part, at least, You Will See Me, which is one of my proudest works,
was written
in a couple of hours as well.
Probably, like, it's definitely, for me... As a producer as well, the best.
Yeah.
Like, still my favourite track is In the Explosions. I don't know why.
It's a weird one as well, because of all these things...
proudest moment is You Will See Me.
Yeah, I'd agree. But I'd also say that we've not mentioned... And this sounds like we're just listing how great our songs are. But
we are.
We're not mentioned a Letter From God to Man, which is one of our, artistically, I think, on both sides, one of our best... works, but because it's got a massive sample in, I think it probably doesn't stick in either of our minds as much, because it's got this big sampling. But again, production wise you chop that up, and that ending again is for our fans an iconic ending to our gigs, just really huge and big. Yet again, it's not one that sticks as much as the ones that we literally built from scratch.
Yeah. It's funny actually, like You See Me, like it's something like you as an artist I think you have to learn as well. It's that I could not write Thou Shalt now.
Yeah.
It's not in the realm of possibility I could write it now. Because I can't unlearn.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and You Will See Me is you asking for something in the same vein as Trampled Youth.
Yeah.
But I couldn't forget everything I'd fucking learned. The drums on...
Again, it's so different, though, as well. Like, anyone who now goes and listens to Trampled Youth who hasn't, they're not that similar, really. There's the build and the buzz. There's that gradual softness.
Yeah.
But in general, it's a very different sound. But again, that's the bringing together all the different elements, I guess.
And like,
it's me shouting about killing everyone.
Gotta give... Although it's a sample pack the drums come from, like, I did a fuck ton of work with them, but... The samples were given to me by a drummer called Timmy Ricard, who is in Sarah Williams White's.
Yeah, he toured with us.
Life.
Didn't he, later after
he
that?
He did, yeah. You can't underestimate the power of just passion, because he's a passionate drummer who cares for how he records, and he puts hours into recording a snare drum, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't... it's all about passion, and everything's about passion. This podcast,
it's all
which
about passion, isn't it?
Is about passion. Like,
yeah.
I think at the end of the day, we live in this world where there's a lot that can get you down, a lot of shit, you know. Like I touched on in part one, like there's stuff that if I fucking let it, you know, will ruin my day.
Yeah.
Or I can fucking reach out, and there's a big stack of fucking DVDs over there, and there's CDs, and I've got access to the internet, and I can just find pure passion.
Yeah.
People who love something they do. The guy who made Minecraft.
Right.
Notch. Marcus, can't remember his surname, but he goes by the name Notch.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So obviously sold Minecraft, made billions.
Yeah.
He writes little bits of graphics, code, just pure code, and makes these crazy visual things.
Yeah.
And they're just web, they run in your browser.
Yeah.
That's passion.
Yeah.
Right there. He makes these gorgeous experiments in mathematics.
Yeah.
That guy doesn't need to do that. guy, he's got billions.
Yeah. He's done well. He's all right,
you know.
He's got it covered.
Yet he will spend his time making something that he's passionate about.
Mm.
You know, you see him actually in Twitch chats just talking about his passion for games.
Yeah.
And that's not just like the monetary reward for making games.
Mm-hmm.
He fucking loves Quake Live.
Yeah. He's
like running around shooting your mates.
Yeah. He's
truly passionate about it. And it's nice to see that humanity, when we constantly are in the pursuit of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to buy a house. I know it's probably not going to happen, but I'm going to try.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if I don't, it's fine. Because
it's not a big deal.
I heard Love Will Tear Us Apart in my life.
Yeah.
And I got to make You Will See Me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've made some women happy. Yeah. And I've made some friends happy. And I have passion for making someone laugh.
Yeah.
Or, you know, orgasm. Actually, that's what it comes down to. Made some chicks orgasm. I won.
You did? I heard about that.
I heard, yeah.
So
it was a big thing. We hired a tent.
There was big news. So what's ahead? I don't want to do the kind of the roundup of kind of favourite gig, folk, because there's fucking as asinine shit, really. We got to tour for many years to many amazing people, and it's all...
Yeah, because it's specific. Like, what's the anatomy of your favourite gig? Like, what, like, because there's, I remember some gigs because they were funny, and some gigs because we just fucking smashed it, and some gigs were amazing just because we stood in front of, you know, there are moments we stood in front of 30,000 people.
Mm.
Can you imagine what that is?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous, man.
At that first big main stage festival one where... You've got the picture there, yeah. Exact picture is the screensaver on my laptop.
Yeah, it's like 15,000 people or something in that photo.
It's more than that, I swear, because Robbie was saying at the time it was over 20,000
really?
at the main stage at that point.
But, like, I don't have a vast amount of memorabilia, like the Strange Famous poster. And,
yeah.
But, like, favourite gigs, impossible. Favourite thing is that we got to meet some amazing motherfucking people.
Yeah.
And it's not just Sage Francis and B. Dolan and Rob the Bank and that. Some of the fucks we met along the way, Like, I don't know, like this, the guy who does these T-shirts.
Right.
No Fit State.
Yeah.
Like, amazing. Yeah. That's a guy who's got some passion for making cool designs. And it's really nice when you see him post a photo of, like, some fucking celebrity who bought his T-shirt.
Yeah.
Like, not that he sent them the T-shirt.
Yeah.
They actually fucking loved it and bought it. And the photographer you work with,
Elisa.
It's like really nice to see her doing well.
And smashing stuff. This is going to a more just, oh my God, it's a famous person one. But do you remember, number one, when we were told that Post Danus from De La Soul had done a vocal for Thou Shalt?
Yeah.
Because we were Sunday Best I Wonder remix done, and I spoke on the phone to Roots Maneuver, who I've since had on the podcast. And it was the weirdest phone call I've ever had. I still lived at my mum's, so I'm in my living room speaking on my phone to Roots Maneuver, and he was being quite odd. He's an odd gentleman.
He may have had some herbals in,
but it was a wonderful one. I can't remember if I told him on the podcast, but I just always remember I rang him and I'm like, he's like, who's this? I'm like, hello, It's Pip Cunning. He's like, ooh, and I was like, oh, we were going to do this track, and I was like, it's Thou Shalt, and he's like, oh yeah, Oasis, Just a Band. I'm like, yeah, and he's like, The Beach Boys, Just a Band. Like, yeah, it's like, The Beatles, Just a Band. Like, yeah, and he just listed like 30 of the, like, almost all of them. I'm like, yeah, that's the one. And we had this weird conversation, so we were looking at Roots Maneuver, we were looking at Mike Skinner maybe, and all sorts.
Yeah.
And then the Daylar thing came in, and I remember the first time that we met Post Danus, we were in Manchester and having to do some press.
And we met him during that interview.
Yeah, he was already there with the Guardian people or whoever it was.
Yeah.
And we were like, hey, man.
The kid was doing it on tape.
That's how we met. And it was, I just remember sitting there as Post fucking Danus from De La Soul, who now, again, talked to and he's a lovely dude. And we've spent more, like, a load of time hanging out with. He's sitting there talking about what he loves about a track that we wrote.
I know.
Like, Are you serious? And again, particularly as you heard on part one, that we wrote that in a couple of hours. I was upstairs at my mum's house.
Yeah.
And but this Posternose thing, is think, going, here's my shit.
I think I can be happy because I still have boyish wonder that anyone gave a shit.
Yeah.
And like when someone, your idol, does anything good.
Yeah.
He's nice.
Yeah.
Just nice that some like someone, I don't know, just feels good that someone would, you admire, would actually admire you back.
Yeah. And we had that with, again, as you said, in all different realms and areas. It's like, fuck, they're into our stuff. That's so weird. There's a connection there. So what's ahead? Obviously, you've got the album coming out on June 8th. Where should people keep an eye out for that or keep up with you? Is it on Twitter and Instagram and all that the best place to...
Yeah, usual. So Facebook? Twitter, Instagram's all...
At Dan Lesak.
At Dan Lesak. And then Facebook's danlesak.official because it wouldn't let me have Dan Lesak for some reason, even though no one's got it.
Yeah.
Just Facebook being weird.
It is weird.
I hate Facebook. To be fair, I'm not a fan. But
the fuckers.
I'm on there occasionally.
Is what it is.
And like, so, but next...
And that's where people can keep up to date on your Twitch stuff. Or is there a specific Twitch thing? Again, I was such a nerd in that first half game. So what, I was like your nan saying, so what's this? What's this new Twitch game thing?
Is twitch.tv/DanLesak _idiot.
And do you have to join it or can you just go on and watch regardless?
You can go on and watch without signing up. This is what I was saying earlier about it being truly free. You don't even need to log in to it to watch.
You can just go to twitch.tv/DanLesak.
Yeah, but if you want to chat in the chat room and have me mock you or you mock me, you have to have an account. But yeah, it's totally free. But yeah, that thing, that I won't stop doing that. Like I say, that's a way of me sitting in my house playing games to relax from fucking making music.
Yeah.
And still keeping it social, still being...
That's the key. As you know, with me, I'm a weird, like, recluse at points and obsessive over things I get into. And my key has always been turning my obsessions into work in some way to justify them. Go, right, I love MMA. Right, now I write a bit and I do a few interviews and that. So therefore, it justifies my weird sitting at home on my own till 6 a.m. watching MMA.
Yeah.
And, well, I've got back into wrestling, and there's now a wrestling podcast on the network. It's like, well, there you go. That's why I was up till 4 last night watching Extreme Rules. And
like, the
shit like that is finding a way to go, here's the things I'm going to be obsessed about. Because everyone talk of obsession or addiction as a negative thing, which they can be. But if you can try and go, right, I'm going to be addicted to something, like, for example, gaming, let's see how I can make that a positive thing.
Yeah.
Let's make it a social thing where I'm interacting,
the social
I'm promoting, I'm being there and being present.
Because making music is such an introspective process for me, especially because I don't do lyrics. I can't just say the words to get it out. I have to find the melody. I have to find that sound.
Yeah.
So that Twitch thing is an amazing part of my mental health. And I can't see me stopping. You know, I've been doing...
That's a really weird a sentence, if you don't know, like, technology and that. That Twitch is a thing is a weird part of my mental health and I don't see me stopping.
But I've, like, in the last 10 days, I think I've streamed 60 hours.
Wow. Damn, you know, that's nuts.
Today's my first day off for 10 days, I think. And I will keep doing that, and that will keep me sane, which means I'll write more.
So it all feeds its...
I'm not planning to do anything live for this record because I want to write something for live.
Yeah.
With that intention that it will come out as a record.
Yeah, I get that.
I want it to be, because it will be the first time I truly stand alone, because I'm not going to have guest vocals or anything like that.
Cool.
Since we stood on a stage together.
Yeah.
It's going to take a bit of something.
Yeah, man.
But
I mean, I expected to have an album finished about a year ago. I ain't done shit, because it is that kind of thing of, it's like, right, I want to, I still think I will release more music, but I only want to release it if it's good enough.
Yeah.
I don't want to just go, well, we built a name. It's kind of thing I don't want to tarnish. Or I'm giving Repeat enough space. So that when I do tarnish it.
That's the thing, like, That idea of I'm not aiming to be bigger than we ever were.
Yeah.
just I'm still that person who, and to be fair, some of the best gigs of my life have been the ones where only 30 people turned up, and we had to work our fucking ass off to make that 30 people not feel awkward about the fact that there were only 30 people.
I always remember, and I'm sure I've told it on the podcast before, or I probably have, I'm not sure, but I have gig in Kingston at like some nightclub that
nightclub.
Had a karaoke room. It had hot dogs on sale in the club.
Yeah. Which is a good idea.
And we played in the Aspen Ski Lodge.
Alpine
Ski Lodge. But then we played in America like a month later was in Aspen in a ski lodge.
In a ski lodge, yeah. So the right. Belly Up.
Yeah. So we played there and we were on at 1 a.m. or something, and there was loads of just drunk people there on drinks promotions. But there was, my memory is 6 people that were there for us.
So that my memory is 9.
9. So it's a divisible of 3. They came in threes. But because of those few who'd had to sit for a shit night, we played our little asses off. And that's one of the most energetic and passionate gigs that we've done. There wasn't a stage.
There wasn't a
gap between us and the crowd.
That gig did make me want to play on a carpet for the rest of our lives. It was just nice standing on carpet.
I thought I might get bottled because someone...
That one guy.
Someone came up and danced mockingly in the middle of one of the vocals. So when it finished, I said, look...
That guy's name was... The promoter's name was Will.
Right.
I think. And he was trying to bring different music into nightclubs. Yeah. So we did that place. We did that.
Because we did the one in Preston.
We're
one of the Ramones.
Marky Ramone.
It was fucking dope. All over that. It was still a shit gig, but a weird gig because it was trying to push them into it. We did the Portsmouth one where the stage was above the bar.
Above the bar.
So literally there's the bar, then us on stage, which caused really weird pockets of excitement because generally the fans are going to be at the front but that's where the bar is, so they couldn't be. So there'd be pockets of excited people around the room, and then a load of people who are like, when are they going to keep playing just Garage or whatever was being pumped out? That's weird as fuck. But at that one, the guy kept dancing in front of me, and I boldly, considering anyone could kick my ass, just said to him, look, play fair, mate. I don't come in your work and dance in front of you when you're trying to put the chip fryer down. And I just thought, there you go. I've just said you work at McDonald's and just had a little attack. So
whereas, like, just didn't get a brief bit of politics. I think
part three.
if people were more willing to work in McDonald's, then I think we'd also be a happier world. Because the amount of people who like these bloody foreigners coming over here, doing all the jobs I don't want to do, paying tax so I can sit on my fucking ass. You know, I just, you know.
Oh, I think
either vote UKIP or go work in McDonald's.
I think we've got a massive problem
with
making all jobs more appealing, because the fact is, none of the most intelligent speakers I see on people I know would want anything to do with being a politician.
No. Yeah, yeah.
So we've made the role of running the country unappealing to the intelligent.
Yeah.
Then that's a fucked up... Like, why are we surprised we're in a shit situation?
Yeah.
And partly it'll be because of our corruptions, but partly it'll be because of the shit that politicians... Like, it's a thankless task in many ways and things like that. So it's a weird one. Yeah, I don't know anyone... Obviously, there are good politicians in tech, but most times you see someone that everyone's going... You should run a country, mate. They'll be like, fuck off, mate. I wouldn't want to do that. Not interested.
It is that thing. We should, if we're going to vote on who leads the country, we shouldn't actually give those people the option to decide whether they want to do it. Yeah. So we can have Stephen Fry up there.
You're doing it. Sorry, mate.
Sorry, mate. Steve, you're up.
Yeah.
It's your time to shine, son. And maybe, I don't know. I don't, that's something. I know we're just rambling on that, but that's definitely something that...
I mean, we've had about 3 perfect finishes, and then we've fucked them up.
You can just cut it off.
No, we both have. I was then like, and then this guy danced in front of me. Wicked, that classic memory of that guy that danced in front of you, and you said a mildly half-funny remark that you haven't even improved in the telling of the story. You could have rewritten and beefed up, fuck's sake.
I don't know what I was going to say. That's probably a good point. What was I going to fucking say? Oh, yeah, nah.
This is like our gigs now.
Fuck it. Oh, God, the amount of times I'd, like, you would cut me off, and for a moment I'd feel offended, And then I'd go, I have just been talking about vaginas for about 7 minutes.
I'd always try to not cut off. I'd always try and just give you the space to come to your natural ending. But then every now and then it'd be like, I don't think this has got a natural ending. This has gone so unnatural as a topic, there's not going to be a natural ending. So it's, every now and then...
It was really funny. I explained how to make a girl orgasm with your fingers.
Yeah.
Like, explained the curve of the female body and where to put pressure. And I did it on stage. And it was just funny. It was just funny. It
worked.
But then...
It was at the time that we were proudly declaring our very righteous and beautiful and positive and shared song, Get Better, to be an anthem for fingering.
An anthem for fingering, yeah. But then we did a gig a few weeks later, and this girl came up to me. She gave me the most fucking tender kiss on the cheek. And, like, not to be crude, but, like, so tender that I was instantly hard. And I was hard for at least an hour later.
I mean, you said not to be crude, but go on.
But, yeah, that was crude. And, like, she just whispered thank you and wandered off. And I was like, what a weird day. And then a fella came up and explained. Rich ruined it. Because at that moment, it was just, thank you for being alive, you beautiful man. But now he came up, he explained it. And he's like, it was brilliant, right?
Taught him the ways of the Jedi.
It was amazing. But he didn't warn me that she was going to squirt. And I was like, why? That's crude. Why would I put that bit in?
Well, there we go on that bombshell. Thank you very much. It's been a good chat. Man. And they said it flies by, man, and we could go for fucking hours, but we'd bore them and we'd both get even cruder. So
we've got a good point
to end it on. But yeah, the new album is out next next week, a week today.
Yeah, I don't know when we are in time, but yeah, June 8th.
So this is June 1st. That's a Wednesday, right? June 1st is a Wednesday. Is it not? It's not, is it?
Fuck knows, man.
Might be June 2nd.
It's the 23rd today.
There you go.
We did this in the past, just ruined it. Yeah, June 8th, Cherished Overthrown on Bandcamp.
Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Let's do this.
That was a good plug.
Yeah, you did it. Smashed it.
Bye!
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That's 100 in the bag, guys. 100 and done. But we're going to do more, obviously. I'm actually, at the moment, I'm struggling a bit with getting the time to get the guests in. So normally when we do the... not anything bad. I had a fair few who have been lined up and then have got busy and about to postpone. So that's all it is. Some really good ones, though. I'll tell you some from Michaela Cole, who's amazing. Frankie Boyle, who else? Organising to line up with Colin Murray. We're lining that one up. There's tons. Hang on, let me get my phone out so I can be more articulate and tell you who we've got lined up and in the coming weeks. But again, it's timing, man. It's not easy to fit these things in. Podcast order, bam, bam, bam. So yeah, Zoe Ashton still being lined up. We need to find the time. Chanel Creswell, Lauren Laverne, Mayanna Burin. So some wonderful, amazing women are really coming up, as well as said, people like Frankie Boyle, Thomas Turgoose, numerous great people. That is all to come soon. Oh, actually, a lot of you keep asking, and we've been lining it up for ages, and it will happen eventually. But Mr. Joseph Gilgan is going to be on at some point. We've discussed it, we've lined it up and then cancelled and gone back and forth, but he's coming, don't worry. And he's smashing it in The Preacher, so I can't wait to talk to the boy and catch up again. There we go. This is the outro, isn't it? I recorded these all in one go and I suddenly forgot if I'm doing an intro or an outro. I'm doing an outro of part two. I think I'm doing an outro of part two of the 100th episode. If this is the intro still, then a buddy piece who puts these together just cut from here and I'll go, all right, well, that was 100 episodes. Thank you. Bye. But thank you all so much for tuning in and spreading the words. I hope this keeps growing and growing and growing. It's amazing where it's got to now. Big love to attached to Woolgie Warren Borg, who started off producing it with me, and then to Buddy Peace, who's taken over, to Amy and Lola, who do the who made the outro music. The little girl on there is my goddaughter Alola, and the appalling musical skills, I believe, is Amy. So yeah, thank you all very much for tuning in. 100 down, and we ain't even close to stopping. Distraction Pieces podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. We out.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.